most derelict churchyard in my parish of Mogdy in West Cork. The lane was windswept and overgrown, memories contained, memories unknown. The crypt fenced in, ivy abounds, in the depths of the graveyard nature surrounds. Landlords once held in lofty esteem, historians wondering what may have been. A sleight of hand, a twist of fate, rough stone reminders carved at the gate. The church now lies naked, nature free to roam. The building lies waste, locals mourn. Windows lie smashed, red glass fragments do reflect, an Irish church once living, dying in sorrow and neglect. The graveyard scattered with mausoleums and tombs, stories of young lives taken too soon. Inscriptions of landlords in need of grace, sharing ground with ordinary peasants here without haste. Heartfelt inscriptions of those who served in war, held dearly by spouses, commemorated in all. Where both communities lie side by side, now we can remember, no longer can hide.
Can we have Bernadette Gallagher, please?
Leave taking. A rustle of dry leaves like rain, the wind singing softly, quietness inside. Our friends return to Copenhagen, London and Cologne. My mother's death day, a kitten adopts us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we have Amelia O'Connell, please?
This is called First Love. Aged 10, she was diligent and shy, not as boisterous as the others. She hardly noticed him at first. Then she heard Vera's urgent whisper, "Look behind you." There he was, on the far side of the room, making the faintest signal with his hand, a sort of half-formed wave. It couldn't be for her. She swiveled back, went on with her sums. Now, as minutes passed, she dared to look again. Yes, he was there, smiling across, looking steadily in her direction. Her throat grew tight. The familiar smell of chalk tickled her nose. Her stomach did a funny somersault. Could this be love? Later, she discovered her mother knew his dad. Back in her younger days, they went to dances in the village hall, or sometimes out sailing in his boat. This revelation gave her courage. Each day, she looked out for his smile. They never spoke, but just by being there, he gave the class a crystal energy. She didn't want the holidays to come. But come they did. Yet she was glad to go back to the coastal village that she loved. One day, when bringing home the milk, fresh from the udder of a neighbor's cow, she found her mother waiting at the door. "You've been invited on a sailing trip with Tig, his son, and all the family." It couldn't be. She spun round on her heel. So he was here. They'd sail. She'd have to speak. A cold shock hit her spine, broke in on her dream. She'd need to step down from the pier, something safe and solid, trust herself to water and the boat. The ocean beckoned, but it seemed too deep. Thank you.
your name again?
Carolyn.
Okay, can we have Philip Spillane, please?
Thank you. So, this is going to be part of my collection of poems called Person Moon. And if you not know what Person Moon, I'll just give a quick introduction. It's basically our set of poems describe our reliance on technology and the Internet of Things, and how that's changing our worlds and changing our social ability, and how we are isolated by this. But I've noticed that all those poems are actually kind of negative, and so I wanted to write one positive one to show the other side, because there is a positive end to all of this. And one way I found of writing it is, if kids of the future ask me what is the internet, this is how I would kind of answer it. So, the internet does not exist anymore. How would I describe it? You know? Part 5, nostalgia. In my day, we wrote the codes, we wrote the clouds, we wrote the doors, we wrote the demands, we were the explorers, we were the followers. And while doing that, we joined the millions of stars and created a crisscross of channels, an unintentional planned network, and what was called then an internet. We were a universe. Back then, we stayed up too late and tapped a keyboard purposely, rhythmically, texting all the stars at the same time, a Morse codes of smiles, which on the outside looked like an isolated laugh, was really a shared emotion from some viral anecdote that was copied and pasted and advertised and shared globally from what was really, and from that we all smiled at the same time. We could send our own faces out into the universe to stars that would never know us otherwise, and invite us in. And at the same time, we indulged and dived and got lost in their outer space, and perhaps got a little jealous, perhaps a little unsafe, perhaps a little addicted. But now that's behind. It's history. It's long ago. It was once upon a time that the young of today will never understand. We can now say that was our world. We pretended then it was a problem. We were something else, but it was our world. It was our own point of history. We were once at its center. Our external virtual limbs, that extra psychic sense, that pocket moon was just in the end a vibrating shell that buzzed, a static, glowing, symbolic shell. But we knew that it was also our keyhole into this vast universe. But then these shells had switches, and we could always switch off when it all became a little too much. And that's when we'll go to sleep. Thank you.
Come here, Paul Curry, please.
When you get to that point of the night, when the chance for love or a fight in the pub or the club of your choice is null and void, it's best to avoid the like-minded types. Now when this, I decide to go home, pop a taxi on my own, no rank around, but there's plenty of strays to be found. Scattered yellow lights always seem to cover disappointed nights in town. I see a heap of closed down shops with dingy flats attached, and a depressed looking Indian chap in a Maxwell garage hatch. Get your Marlboro lights for deforced by the brats, and as we make brief eye contact, a lonely drifter from the herd of a pack of taxis emerges at me back. Naturally, he ignores my attempt to hail him in so he can give me a lift. Continues driving like I don't exist, and I don't know whether I'm going crazy or if I'm Patrick Swayze in that movie Ghost. These taxi men aren't seeing me. When this happens and they ignore you so many times, you contemplate hurling yourself across the double yellow lines, let the stairs, the bodies, the upper course of bonnets combine and collide for the last ever time. A taxi man will ignore me in his life. But just then one pulls in with a cheeky grin. Where are you going, kid?
Kilrock.
Up in. And as I take the back seat, I notice little things. The bat that black leather on his Toyota Corolla 5-seater, the Padre Pio prayer on touch beside the firm meter, the gentle scent of nice baguette and mistakes the tail blended with new car smell. Out in the gargle with and I can tell not just by what he said, but the way he said it, that he's the stereotypical taxi driver type of fella who gives the impression that he loves talking about the recession. I mentioned, for Saturday night, there's not many people around town, which is the type of thing you say when you can't find a common ground. Ah, bleeding dead out there. More taxis than people. And I'm not along, let him know that we're equals. The last thing I need in the trip home is rear view equals, and he's driving like a lunatic. Look, his last name's Knievel. I try my best not to panic. And I notice AC/DC is playing. I hadn't taken him for a Radio Nova addict. And I say, as I sink back in my seat, yeah, just left at the lights here, Chief. He proceeds to question me. He asks about my life, I ask about his life. I'm in college, he's on a second wife. I ask about the kids, best way to break the ice. Fact is, he's a lad just trying to get by. And it'd be lying if I said we weren't essentially the same inside. Only difference is my life is reading books and his is transporting drunks. Like most others, we find ourselves in a similar position. Oils tired, lives never transported to the dreamed of conditions. We both had goals that never came to fruition. His with the addition of keys and an ignition. He meets 1,000 10-minute friends a night under the glow of his taxi light. And as he bobs and waves through housing schemes and 1550s with the meter reads and the light of the prayer in the warm letter seats, I say, yeah, just drop us off me where you please. And I dispense with the expense of the transport fees and he is free to live. Then he dwindles away like a shivering flame. And he totally goes like a puff of smoke. For me, brush the teeth, hit the sack, as you do. For him, orange, red, green. O'Connell Street. Back at a queue. Thank you.
This is a very short piece of fiction called This Is a Matter Of. Security was a young boy growing up in the Bronx in New York City, playing around trying to make a living, when he was approached by a suited gentleman from the industry. The suited gentleman brought security to his office and signed him on a lifelong development contract. Security was young and ambitious and therefore thought otherwise about asking any questions. You're going to be huge, said the suited gentleman. Just you wait and see. As long as you've got the chops to keep up, you'll be huge. Just you wait and see. You wait and see. Security had not yet entered the Great Depression of adulthood and had not the foresight to see anywhere beyond his dreams. Happy he was. In a few months, security had spread all over his locality. Everyone knew who he was. He had become a household name in New York. A few months later, he had gone national and was bestowed with the nickname National Security. National Security sold out every venue he visited. They made National Security toys, videos, video games, music videos, films and film cameos, toothbrushes and toothpaste, shower gel and soap, and toilet paper with National Security's face woven into the three-ply paper. Things kept on getting better for security, and soon enough he went international, becoming the first person in living memory to achieve the status of International National Security. The suited gentleman had struck a deal with his international partners. Security toured all over the world, doing a record number of tours in the Middle East, more than any of his comrades could even dream of. But security started to realize one evening, staring out over the gardens of Babylon, that he still didn't feel existentially fulfilled. He wanted more personal and creative freedom from his friend, the suited gentleman. They argued for hours over the phone, eventually arranging a meeting in Paris. After long, arduous talks, security managed to convince the suited gentleman of his plea. His contract was terminated. He was free. Security had gained his freedom. The media labelled the whole story as Sexit in the Daily News and criticised security for promoting autarky in a global world of interdependence. Security fled from the media and avoided all forms of social interaction until security was informed that his father had died. Security had to return to the United States after many years abroad, but was stopped at immigration on his arrival in the airport. Security always had sallow skin, whereas now, after many years in the sun, he had developed something of a tan. He had become a brown person. Security refused to cooperate with the authorities and was nevertheless deported. Security couldn't prove it, but he spun a conspiracy in his mind that his deportation had something to do with his friend, the suited gentleman. National Security, as he had now become known internationally, decided to go on tour again in the Middle East, his favourite set of destinations. He spread his word of protest at every venue and became quite the demagogue. He built up what the US media labelled as a campaign of hatred against us in the Middle East. National Security fought hard and long for his cause, a cause that reached its apex when National Security arranged a festival in the deserts of Iraq, not too far from his beloved Baghdad. A record number of people were in attendance, women, men, and thousands of children chanted in National Security's favour. And as National Security walked on stage to greet the thousands of people in the audience, a threatening silence fell over them all. There was something in the sky. All the birds flew away. Some children began to cry for their mothers. The sweltering sun was blocked out by a single clay-coloured cloud. A US drone hovered above them for a moment before it struck. There were no survivors.
Thanks, Ali. Give me off Charles Clark, please.
I'm not reading something of my own, but I have made a small literary discovery. In a poem by written quite a long time ago called The Northern Ireland Troubles at Great Length by Paul Muldoon. The more a man has, the more a man wants. It's frightfully clever, of course. I read a bit first, give you a general idea of what he's up to. A roaring lorry on a routine delivery is taking a slow, dangerous bend. The driver's blethering his code name over the citizen's band, and someone ambles in front of him. Go, Johnny, go, Joe, go. He's being dry gulched by a 16-year-old nun with Mogadon, whose face is marked by the seamless black stocking filch in his mouth. And then this verges away. It's something quite different, it would seem. And in at the end of this, there is a well-known, an adaptation of, what's it, a well-known old Irish poem, which I read here quite a short time ago, translated by Miles Dillon, along with some other things. The son of the King of Moy, son of the King of Moy, in mid-summer, found a girl in the greenwood. She gave him black fruit from thorn bushes. She gave him an armful of strawberries on rushes. Our friend goes on. When who should walk in but Beatrice, large as life or larger, sipping her one glass of lager and singing her one song. If he had to do it all over again, he would let her shave his head in memory of 98, and her own, the black, the French Revolution. The son of the King of Moy met this child on the Roxburgh estate. Noblesse, she said, noblesse, oblige. And her tiny nipples were bruised, bluish, wild raspberries. The song she sang was the Coffee Boy.
Thanks, Charles. Give me up Patricia Walsh, please.
It's all paradise and trouble. Repetitive eyesores fool no one, failing to topple your vainglorious regime. Nicely living well at concatenation's revenge, dryly point out effect and so cause, sinking dry wit for a better chance. Recurring sights irk ever the most robust, closing in on remembered sarcasm. Heart holding fast in spite of earthquakes. Fighting corners in a willful position. No associates would ever redeem you. Well, against the barbarism, one without grace, savour once forgotten, slipped from view. Electronic wish list, scaling your heights, always in the gutter, actions pertaining, barbed actions trying very hard to redeem. Alcohol serves words, scaling for attention. What you represent is not your calling. The next best thing sinking under water's weight, the hopeful buried in circumstances' grave. Lightly disastrous love as have lived, resurrecting an event to a cold prize, believing fate a cause unwilling fulfilling its own self, a flawless finish awaits your goal, an earlier heaven a dark prophecy. Thank you.
Next Patricia, can we have Margaret Phelan, please?
Sorry about today. Okay, this is just thoughts on life. Sorry. I threw my life across the floor and in a heap it tumbled, lying there in prostrate gait, tied up and all a-jumbled. I smoothed it here and teased it there and made no sense and stumbled upon some forgotten memories, some loud, some proud, and some humbled. Gently of my life I picked and held it close to me, thankful for the chance of life, whatever that may be. It's good to sometimes to throw your life across the floor to see the footprints you have made on earth that last eternally.
Can we have Natalie Pollard, please?
It's called Icy Shells. Shells of me, shells of me, shells of grey and shells of steel. Tin cans whistle by on metal rims. The rustling change, they count to get in. Smoke, fumes and weary woes. Struggle from the resting post, spare change or a hope. Gazed are the reflections that echo through these city walls. These bustling streets contain the pity. Shells of me I see, shells of all those shadows left by grief. The shells of homes once filled with heat, shells now cold on unforgiven streets. Lights flickers and futures fade. Wet winds won't wash the shame from their faces. Industrialized mayhem and no work for a trade. I pity the shells that come with the morning tide. For them shells of sand and grit and concrete. This is the shells you must eat. This is the shells you are forsaken to see. Thank you.
Well done.
Our penultimate reader tonight is Ed O'Byrne.
This is a piece called Do They Pay? Nations stand and nations fall. One line crumbles while another grows tall. Too many men they fight for claim to this land. Too many men's blight brought by own hand. They say that peace is here to stay, yet bloodshed's liquors day to day. In the end, who really pays? The men? The women, the children, the neck. These are but the innocents dragged into brass wars. Their hand to a gun and told what it's for. They aim down the sights with shade and fear. Unable to fire, an enemy they spare. Back home is but a distant memory of a life torn asunder, once full of prosperity. They ask why the fight, but the answer is always the same. You fight for this country, or you shall die in vain. The suits in charge drink from crystal goblets. Sit back and relax while their men die in bomb blitz. They say her son, he died with great honor, yet the wails on the battlefield tell of sorrow's fodder. They say her brother, he died a great hero, the price of his loss much less than a zero. Men are but the cogs in the war machines they lead. while death amongst ignorance is how they all feed. A dime for a dozen is a term you might say. A dime for a dozen they will never truly pay.
Thanks, Ed. Our last reader tonight is Max Green.
Hey.
Like to have something light, but I have to do something tonight for someone I think a vitamin is 2.5, and he was a bearer of gifts and a very dodgy driver, but he stayed closer than any sibling. So it's soon to say, but it's a recollection, not a book. So a tiny little piece of music. The lambs in the green fields, they sport and they play, and many strawberries go round the salt sea, and many strawberries grow round the salt sea, and many's the ship sails the ocean. Don't you break. So, well, no, named for the luminous one, one kind of light undiminished, warm still by the loved and the unloved. Echoes loud laughter, bubbling surges, it played a water music for me. Notes scored above and beneath deep waters. Deep profundus, you sing a baritone of thought, a rich treble of words, and had a colourful script to illuminate it. Lights dance through the chamber of so many hearts. You lift a lift for aging spirit, envelop the lost and the disenfranchised. You gladden many's a sad eye. Cheer the despairing youth or its demise. You remember the forgotten, then and now. Light and sound obey their laws, but their beams can bend and resonate too. And they send to mind the sound and vision of you when I hear a happy cacophony. How are you bumshed after all these years, when all I had was your voice and a multi-coin box in a random hallway of summer tears? My soggy hair and a threadbare turban. No Tallulah banquet this month. Come with me, Megsy, and I'll bring you to the Royal Maritime Museum. We had cheesecake in the mall, and such a thrill for a broke repeats girl. You knocked me down once in the flying gravel in your dusty black Volkswagen. Beyond the big bridge, me and my borrowed high nilly. Above my arm's reach, probably Conjo's. And up he sashes past on his buzz bang, clueless. And I wondered, my scuffed plume, would Conjo ever know? Bustling through the gravel again, on our way to photos our brethren, through the coned cul-de-sac of an untracked, untarred motorway track. Ah, should you look at that lovely folly there? And we all looked the wrong way, and back again, just in time. The bags and the molly, the gypsy scarfs that surfed the one Diane von Fustenberg, the baubles among one aquamarine gender, and that look, you love the way the lady's dressed. Oh, that's very lovely on you. I like those earrings the best. You're welcome for a youth lost in his way, the silver flute in the blue velvet case. You launched so many notes he played, and the guitar in the case, worth more than its weight of gold that sits by his heart today. The emails that spoke your care, considered, felt, but so diplomatically aware. And late on August 12th, an anniversary of our own and a tragic time, you wished us well, asked our news, gave us yours, and our words entwined. In the plans of thoughts and dreams to come, I wish you rest, Michael Balishinkov. My godfather is home. That's it.